From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet two members of the AIDS activist group ACT UP. Tracy Morgan and Alden McCain tell us what more could be done in the fight against AIDS. Also today, defense correspondent James Adams of the Sunday Times of London examines how Iraq built its arsenal. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles one of the people who helped shape the sound of New Orleans, arranger Dave Bartholomew. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Postcards from the Edge, starring Meryl Streep and Shirley MacLaine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq has warned the U.S. of possible terrorist attacks because of what it termed crimes and insults against Arab countries. According to the official Iraqi news agency, the warning comes in response to a message from the U.S. government, which said that terrorist groups with bases in Iraq are preparing for attacks against targets of the U.S. and its allies. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is in Saudi Arabia, where he's been touring U.S. bases. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, got hot and thirsty today during a tour of American forces in Saudi Arabia. This is his first trip to the region 5 weeks after American troops started arriving. Powell's mission is to boost morale among soldiers who are asking when they're going home. Many said today they arrived with a sense of urgency, but 5 weeks into the operation, they want to see the mission accomplished. Powell said he addressed the issue of live fire with the Saudis. Saudi Arabian officials had prevented American troops from firing their sophisticated weapon systems in training exercises. Last night, one unit was allowed the first live fire test. In Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
Iraqi forces are stepping up their campaign against what's described as the small but growing Kuwaiti resistance movement. Meanwhile, some members of the resistance are questioning whether the al-Sabah family should return with the same powers to rule should Iraq pull out. The BBC's Jack Thompson reports.
The resistance is said to be most active in three areas of Kuwait City, Salwa and Fintus, straddling the coastal motorway to the south, and the southern suburb of Sura. In Fintus, Iraqi forces are reported to have used mortars to demolish the top floor of a block of offices and flats after coming under sniper fire from the roof. One woman who's just arrived in London on an evacuation flight from Kuwait said the Iraqis were being highly systematic. Using detailed maps, they'd carried out their searches sector by sector. Another woman described how Iraqi troops shot any Kuwaiti caught writing anti-Saddam Hussein graffiti or simply burned down Kuwaiti houses as a reprisal. All of which suggests that after ignoring the resistance in the early days of their occupation, the Iraqis now regard it as a serious threat, which has to be ruthlessly eliminated.
Jack Thompson of the BBC. The Bush administration pushed today for passage of clean air legislation, saying that the pollution controls required by the bill could save as much as 1 million barrels of oil a day. The report was made public to counter some efforts in Congress to use the oil crisis as a way to defeat pollution controls. The legislation is being negotiated in a joint House-Senate committee. Pollution controls in the bill are expected to cost the energy industry as much as $25 billion a year by the end of the decade. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 43 points to close at 2,582.67. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-2 in light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The fight against AIDS has become a very politicized fight. Many say that the government was slow in responding to the epidemic because the disease has largely struck people outside the white, heterosexual middle class. The group ACT UP was founded in 1987 to focus attention on the need for better medical care and increased funding for research. ACT UP also works on behalf of the rights of people with AIDS, rights to health care, housing, and employment. ACT UP is an acronym for AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. The group is controversial because of their confrontational tactics and acts of civil disobedience. Trading at the New York Stock Exchange was temporarily disrupted when several ACT UP members handcuffed themselves to a railing to protest the high cost of AZT. The group disrupted High Mass at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York as a statement against the church's condemnation of homosexuality and the use of condoms. My guests are two members of the New York chapter of ACT UP. Alden McCain has participated in several of ACT UP's confrontational actions. He's a member of the Caucus for People with Immune System Disorders. Tracy Morgan is one of the authors of ACT UP's forthcoming handbook on women and AIDS. McCain says ACT UP may be controversial, but their tactics work.
There are some very clear and direct results. For example, in the case of lowering the price of AZT, that's a case where we had an action on Wall Street demanding that the price of AZT be lowered, and the next week the price of AZT in fact was lowered. Just this past week, a couple of things have happened. We've been trying to get access to a drug called DDC, and the company that makes DDC, Hoffman LaRoche, was putting a lot of impediments in the way of what they call an expanded access. There were things that people had to go through. They had to have failed on both AZT and another drug called DDI. And all we had to do with Hoffman LaRoche was threaten them with an action. We threatened to go and picket their board of directors meeting this past Monday night. And the mere threat of that action backed up with our history, the fact that they know that we were at the FDA and the CDC and San Francisco, that threat was sufficient to get them to call us up on the phone and say, "You're right. We're going to change our policy. We're going to allow access to DDC even without the restrictions that we had before."
Tracy, one of the things that you've worked on is the Women's Handbook Committee mm-hmm. of ACT UP. And I'd like to talk about some of the issues that apply to women with AIDS. I think the point has been made lately that women have been undercounted and that women manifest the HIV virus in different ways, with different symptoms than mm-hmm. men do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Women do manifest HIV differently, and it's a very political thing that women's gynecological manifestations of HIV are not being taken into account by the Centers for Disease Control. We see a lot of women, I also happen to do service provision, healthcare, and we see a lot of women who come in who are HIV positive with pelvic inflammatory disease. We see women coming in with chronic vaginitis, with cervical cancer, accelerated numbers of abnormal pap smears, for instance. Okay, we see these women come in and they're HIV positive, but they can't get an AIDS diagnosis if they just have one of these problems. These problems are not considered to be HIV related. Were they to be considered to be HIV related, that means that the government that is supplying people who have an AIDS diagnosis with a certain amount of funds, let's say from supplemental security income to access to different AIDS drugs and so on, this means that these women without an AIDS diagnosis are not getting the assistance to give them at least a substandard quality of life that they need to survive with this disease. Gynecological care in the AIDS crisis is considered to be, like a fringe benefit. I mean, you can't get gynecological care even at most AIDS clinics in New York City, for instance. So that means that women who are positive and are showing GYN symptoms are not receiving treatment.
When you talk about the definition of AIDS, is there a list of certain symptoms that someone has to have before being officially diagnosed with AIDS?
Right. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta basically produced the original definition of AIDS, which has been refined once only slightly and is now totally out of date. There are a number of conditions, as Tracy mentioned, that affect women that are not included in the CDC definition but are sometimes, in fact, fatal. There are other conditions that affect IV drug users, intravenous drug users, that are not included in the CDC definition and are, in fact, fatal. And there are also conditions that now affect all people who have HIV infection who are now living longer because there are some treatments for some of the conditions that in the early phase of the disease killed people. And as people are living longer and developing these other conditions that can be fatal, those conditions are also not included in the CDC definition. I myself have had an HIV-related pneumonia, which is not part of the CDC definition. I also am, for the last almost 8 years now, have had a T-cell count below 200. And I won't get into all the details about what a T-cell count is, but basically the medical community in general believes that someone whose T-cells are below 200 has a very seriously compromised immune system and needs care. Now, I fortunately have private health insurance, but if I were relying on public assistance and Medicare to take care of me, it would be very difficult for me to get the treatment that I would need, and in some states it would be impossible for me to get that treatment. And the reason is this definition of AIDS that is so restrictive.
Do you plan on participating in any actions? Does ACT UP have any plans to do anything to change, to broaden the definition of AIDS?
We are going to go to the Health and Human Services, and we're going to go to the Centers for Disease Control, and we're going to stage a massive protest, which will be a follow-up to a protest that took place last December, where we got a lot of promises. We were told that they were working on revising the definition of AIDS. Well, here it is 10 months later, and nothing has changed. There has been no change, and we've told them that we're going to be back unless they change the definition. And we'll keep coming back until they do change it, and eventually they will.
Let me get to one of the criticisms I've heard some people make of ACT UP, and that is, for instance, at this demonstration at the CDC, you want the CDC on your side, and there are a lot of researchers there who are really working hard on the AIDS crisis, and who might feel... You put them in a crazy position, because here they are, like, devoting their lives to doing research on AIDS, and now they're the victim. You know, they're the subject of a protest. No, I'm sorry, they're the subject
target.
Of a target. Thank you, thank you. So.
Well, I think that the best way to answer that is perhaps to look at the National Institutes of Health and the AIDS Clinical Trial Group system as opposed to CDC, where, because I think that there the situation is much clearer. That's where the basic research on treatments and preventatives or prophylaxis for basic AIDS condition or the AIDS virus, HIV itself, as well as the opportunistic infections. That's where all that research is done. Now, ACT UP started 3 years ago. One of our first targets was the Food and Drug Administration. As a result of our activities, there are now a variety of drugs that are available, I think, as a direct result. There are also now trials being done in the AIDS Clinical Trial Group. We still have a great deal of work to do. But one of the things that's happened is that we, in fact, have begun to establish relationships with some of the people who are doing research in the AIDS Clinical Trial Group system. And some of those people are telling us, look, we know that this system is screwed up. We know it's rotten, but we risk our jobs if we point it out from inside. However, here's what's wrong, and would you please go and confront these people? That happens routinely.
So you think that there are a lot of people within the CDC and groups like that who are glad that you are putting the pressure on?
There are definitely researchers within the federal bureaucracy, both at the CDC and within the AIDS Clinical Trial Group system, who are fed up with the people who are running these organizations, who know that the people who are running these organizations in many cases are more interested in their own careers than in really helping people with AIDS, and who welcome our help in changing that situation.
Mm-hmm. Alden, a lot of the people in ACT UP have AIDS, and I wonder if some of them feel that time is running out, that problems need to be solved soon.
Well, that's
and I wonder if that motivates the kind of actions that ACT UP takes.
I think there's a certain sense in which that is true. Yes, we do know. I do know that I'm not going to live forever in the absence of an effective treatment for this virus that I'm carrying around. So I do know that I cannot wait forever. I cannot allow the medical and research bureaucracy of this country to go through its normal routine to eventually come up with a treatment. I have to be in their face because my life is on the line. Yes, that is true.
You recently had a bad experience in a hospital during a bout with pneumonia. Can you tell us what happened, and if you think that gets at any kind of typical problems that people with AIDS are facing now in New York or in other cities?
Unfortunately, it's all too typical. I went to the emergency room of what is supposed to be one of the best hospitals for treating AIDS in the country, and went into the emergency room with pneumonia, with a severe fever, barely able to walk, and I was stuck in a waiting room for over an hour. When I finally was seen, I was taken into what appeared to have been at one time some sort of utility closet. which was now converted into two emergency examination rooms, the two parts of the room separated from each other by a curtain, such that once I was put on the hospital bed, then another patient was taken in, past me through the curtain to the other side of the curtain. Once I was diagnosed, I was put on a gurney in a hallway outside the emergency room. I was stuck on this gurney. There were, in this hallway, there were about five positions that were marked off on the floor with masking tape with little paper signs stuck to the wall that said H1, H2, H3 through H5, H standing for hallway. So in other words, what was happening was the hospital is so overcrowded, the demands placed on the hospital system in New York City are so overwhelming the New York hospitals that hospitals are now resorting to calling a piece of ground in a hallway, a hospital room, H1, H2. Now, I was reasonably lucky that the HIV-related pneumonia that I had was treatable. So I was given medication, and I was able to leave the hospital. A friend of mine, Sal Licata, actually went to the same hospital the very next day and spent 3 days in one of these little spaces marked off on the floor in a hallway on a gurney, never got into a hospital room, and died on that gurney. That's what's going on in New York. And, you know, I have to say to the rest of America, that's what's in New York now. That's what's going to be in your town in 3 or 4 years, unless you push the federal bureaucracy to do something about AIDS and unless you begin to plan in your hospital systems to meet the needs of people with AIDS.
I know one of the criticisms I've heard about the way research is being handled for AIDS is that all the attention seems to be going toward the HIV virus and not enough attention going towards drugs that can treat the opportunistic infections that strike people who have HIV and who have no immune system left. I wonder what you think about that.
Well, it's absolutely true, and it's criminal. One of the things that we did when we had our action at the National Institutes of Health last May was that we took a look at the National Institute of Health's own statistics on the AIDS clinical trial group system. And what we saw astounded us. What we saw was that about 80% of the people in clinical trials for AIDS-related drugs were in trials of a single drug called AZT. Now, that is a drug that fits very nicely into really into the career goals of people doing the research, because it's a drug that attacks the underlying virus causing AIDS in a very interesting way from a virological point of view. It inhibits the reproduction of reverse transcriptase. Now, if that were to work, it would be a real feather in the cap of the researchers. On the other hand, the drugs and prophylaxis for the opportunistic infections have a couple of things going against them. First of all, a smaller number of people are affected by each individual opportunistic infection, so therefore not as much money is going to be made on each drug that will be a treatment or preventative for the opportunistic infections. And the second thing is that generally they're not as fancy as a reverse transcriptase virus is. So therefore, one is less likely to win a medical prize or perhaps even a Nobel Prize for working in those areas. Now, the result of those two things in combination, plus the fact that a lot of these researchers have long-standing relationships with the pharmaceutical companies, and the pharmaceutical companies are much more interested in drugs like AZT, which are very expensive and can generate profits because a lot more people will use them, the combination of all those factors leads to this situation where 80% of the people in trials are in trials of this one drug, leaving very little of the medical establishment's research resources to attack opportunistic infections, to look at other ways of attacking the HIV virus, or to look at ways of rebuilding the immune system.
I just want to get back to what you were talking about before with the hospital. Maybe I missed this, but was this a public hospital?
It was not a public hospital.
It was a private hospital, right. And it was still so overcrowded.
Right.
And
yeah, and the public hospitals are even worse.
So what do you have any recourse if you get sick again? Would you go to a different hospital? Would you have anything in your power to do to try to get a better experience?
Well, frankly, I have had friends in all of the hospitals that treat AIDS patients in this city, and I can tell you that none of the others are any better. The situation is the same, and indeed even worse. The public hospitals are just frightening. They are so overcrowded as not to be believed. I mean, I recommend to anyone who wants a quick education in how rapidly the healthcare system in this city and in this country is falling apart, just wander into any emergency room of any hospital in New York. You'll see very quickly.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guests are both members of the group ACT UP, Alden McCain and Tracy Morgan. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the group ACT UP. I have two guests, Alden McCain and Tracy Morgan. Tracy, let's get back to something we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
You're describing how AIDS is defined as a certain collection of symptoms, and women often have different symptoms
mm-hmm.
when they have AIDS. Can you describe for us what the official definition of AIDS is and how that leaves women out?
Okay, well, what's... Some of the official symptoms, let's do a list. Pneumocystis, pneumonia, oral thrush, let's see.
Oral thrush actually is a very good example of what you're talking about.
Right.
Because the same organism that causes oral thrush also causes a vaginal condition.
Right, a vaginal candidiasis. And when you have, you know, oral thrush is, you know, you look in someone's mouth and you see it's covered with a white yeast. Now, many women have yeast infections in early stages of HIV infection that are vaginal. Okay, but that's not considered a part of the definition. Now, I believe if you have thrush and you're HIV positive, you get an AIDS diagnosis. But if you're a woman and you're HIV positive and you have vaginal thrush, simply based on the location of your thrush, okay, you do not get an AIDS diagnosis. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
And if you don't get an AIDS diagnosis, that means what else won't
you don't
get?
Well, if you don't get an AIDS diagnosis, you don't get a lot of the monies that are allocated by state and federal governments to help you out to live. We mentioned before supplemental security, which is, you know, to give you extra money every month. Other things like access to free AIDS drugs. Other things like access to more extensive Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera. You don't have access to those kinds of benefits that people with AIDS and an AIDS diagnosis have access to.
Tracy, you work with a lot of poor women mm-hmm. through healthcare centers.
Right.
And I'm wondering what other problems you think women mm-hmm. in particular have who have AIDS.
Problems that women have. Women are poorer than men. That's a really huge problem. Women tend to be more reliant on public health care, on public hospitals, on Medicaid, on clinics. Women tend to have to not have private doctors. Women tend to have poor diets. Women tend to be taking care of other people. Women who are HIV positive, I think in New York City, have between 2 and 3 children. You know, so women have a lot of other concerns. Wages for women are lower if women are working. And if you're HIV positive and female in this country and poor, you know, it's a triple whammy.
Tracy, do you feel that we know as much about transmission heterosexually of AIDS or transmission from woman to woman of AIDS? Or do you think we know more about man-to-man transmission?
Well, I think that we know a fair amount about heterosexual transmission, and we know very little about woman-to-woman transmission. Everything is anecdotal when you talk about safe sex for lesbians.
Alden, I have a question for you. You're mm-hmm. on You're on the Committee of ACT UP, which is going by the acronym of PIST, People with Immune System Disorders.
That's correct.
What are the most pressing issues that you're talking about now in that group?
Well, I think that all the things that we've been addressing here today are very pressing. We have ACT UP as a group has just decided to do a couple of things over the next year and a half or so. We have just embarked on a what we're calling an 18-month countdown. Actually, it'll be officially kicked off in another month and a half. An 18-month countdown to make all of the opportunistic infections treatable and or preventable. And that obviously is something that is of very great importance to people who are members of my caucus, people with immune system disorders. We are also starting a real campaign, actually joining up with other groups around the country to work for national health insurance, because one of the things that we see from our experience, and certainly this is true of people who are part of the PIST caucus, is that even if we get these drugs tested and approved and made available, a lot of people will not have access to them simply because they do not have health insurance. We need a system in this country such that when there is a treatment, somebody who is poor, unemployed, does not have insurance, will be able to have access to it.
Because you have a low
T-cell count?
Yeah, because you have a low T-cell count and immune system problems now, you probably really have to take care of yourself. And I'm wondering if it's if you're worried about devoting too much time to ACT UP. I don't know if you probably have a job as well. I mean, do you feel like you have to prevent yourself from burning out on the politics of the issue to protect your own health?
Yeah, I worry about that to a certain extent. But I have to say that on the whole, I think my experience in ACT UP has been empowering. And other people who are in the same condition as I am, that is, people who have compromised immune systems, say the same thing. And as I look at people who have survived with this disease for a long time, one of the things that I notice is that invariably they are people who are doing something about it. And it may not necessarily be that they're involved in ACT UP. They may be involved in other AIDS organizations. But they're doing something. And I think that perhaps that sense of empowerment, that sense of doing something, has something to do with why some people tend to live longer than others. Obviously, there's no way to show that scientifically. But I know that I personally have a strong sense of taking some measures that are going to influence my health. And that in itself, I think, does influence my health.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you.
My guests have been Tracy Morgan and Alden McCain. They're both members of the AIDS activist group ACT UP. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, the drummer of the rock band The Doors, John Densmore. He's written a new memoir. I hope you can join us.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down. When you're strange, faces come out of the rain. When you're strange, no one remembers your name. When you're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Iraq built its arsenal with the help of the Soviet Union, West Germany, England, and the United States. Coming up, we talk with James Adams, defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, about dictators and high-tech weapons. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles New Orleans arranger Dave Bartholomew. He helped shape the sound of such performers as Fats Domino, Lloyd Price, and Smiley Lewis. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Postcards from the Edge, the new movie version of actress Carrie Fisher's semi-autobiographical novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraq has warned the U.S. of possible terrorist attacks because of what it termed crimes and insults against Arab countries. According to the official Iraqi news agency, the warning comes in response to a message from the U.S. government, which said that terrorist groups with bases in Iraq are preparing for attacks against the U.S. and its friends. Meanwhile, the White House has denied that the U.S. ambassador to Iraq may have given President Saddam Hussein the green light to invade Kuwait. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Iraqi officials released a transcript of a July 25th conversation between Saddam Hussein and the U.S. Ambassador April Gillespie. According to the transcript, Saddam Hussein gives explicit warnings that his government will take action against Kuwait, which the Iraqi president claimed was waging economic war against his country. U.S. Ambassador Gillespie responds, saying the U.S. takes no official position on Iraq's border dispute with Kuwait. The thrust of the exchange appears to emphasize that Saddam Hussein had reason to believe the U.S. would not oppose his invasion of Kuwait. U.S. officials declined to comment on the authenticity of the transcript, but White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater says it is ludicrous and stupid to believe that the U.S. would have given Iraq a green light to invade Kuwait. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
According to diplomatic sources, Syria has agreed to send additional forces to Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government reportedly asked Damascus to send an armored division to join the U.S.-led military deployment in the Persian Gulf area. Jonathan Burchell of the BBC has more.
According to Western diplomats in Damascus, Syria is planning to send as many as 15,000 more troops to the Gulf to join over 3,000 special forces paratroops already in Saudi Arabia. The new deployment will include both tanks and artillery. It's already emerged from Cairo that Egypt is planning to send at least 12,000 more troops to the Gulf, also equipped with tanks and heavy equipment. And the two countries will now form the backbone of the Arab forces standing alongside the Americans in the Gulf. There are likely to be financial benefits for Syria as well. Kuwait's government in exile has said it will pay Syria outstanding financial contributions. Saudi Arabia is also expected to offer financial assistance. And the European community has already recognized Syria's claim that it suffered economic damages as a result of the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait.
Jonathan Burchell of the BBC in Damascus. Amoco Production has announced an agreement with the Soviet Union that could lead to a joint venture for development of oil fields in western Siberia. Amoco has been holding talks with Soviet officials on a possible joint venture since 1988. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 43 points to close at 2,582.67 in very light trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. If you love the golden era of New Orleans rock and roll, the one that included Lloyd Price, Fats Domino, and Sugar Boy Crawford, then you've heard the work of Dave Bartholomew, but you may not know his name. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says Bartholomew is one of the music's great invisible men, an arranger.
Although Dave Bartholomew's band and his arrangements dominated the Crescent City scene from 1948 until 1963, and although he released dozens of records under his own name, he never achieved the fame of his clients. Dave Bartholomew's father was a noted New Orleans musician himself, so it was probably foreordained that his son would follow in his footsteps when he came into the world on Christmas Eve in 1920. Young Dave played with Fats Pichon's band until he was drafted in 1942, And while he was in the Army, he played in a military band and learned arranging, one of the few times the Army has helped rock and roll. In 1949, he cut a record for the first label to do talent scouting in post-war New Orleans, Deluxe, and Country Boy, his second record for them, sold 100,000 copies. Here's the follow-up.
She's just a country girl, running wild in this big old town. She's just a country girl, running wild in this big old town. Well, all the boys love her, 'cause they know what she's put down.
Country Gal didn't do as well, but it marked a turning point in his career. It was recorded for Lou Chudd, who had just started Imperial Records, and asked Bartholomew to be his talent scout in New Orleans. Given the results, he couldn't have picked a better guy.
Big Chief has a temper mind. Chudd's gonna go down home by. Chudd went back the way home by. Chudd went back the way home by.
Early tribute to Mardi Gras shows, Bartholomew was adept at taking the unique New Orleans rhythms and integrating them into a blues band context that was up to the minute. Add that to Fats Domino's inimitable piano style, and you had yourself a hit. Domino's string of Dave Bartholomew-arranged hits put Imperial Records on the map in 1950, so Lou Chudd gave his talent scout carte blanche. Bartholomew started recording himself whenever he could squeeze in time during a session by another artist. Along the way, he made some stunning records.
With my pipes as dry as chalk, I bought myself a bill, then I had to take a walk. While I was gone, some no good John had drank up my last dime. I never thought a man would stoop to such a petty crime. Who drank my bill while I was in the rear? Please tell me somebody.
He also made some classically silly ones like this one, and these days they're what he's best known for. Great arranger though he wasn't much of a vocalist, so novelty records served him best.
I'm an old cowhand from a blues band, and my mommy don't want me to jam, but I don't care what mama don't allow. I'm going to sing my blues anyhow.
Bartholomew even recorded a series of dirty blues songs like The Iceman and the original version of My Ding-a-Ling. Luther Campbell should listen to them to learn about subtlety. Sorry, I'm not going to play them here. It's arguable that without Dave Bartholomew, lots of the big names in New Orleans rock and roll would never have made the charts, that it was his arranging expertise that put Imperial at the front of the record labels that were mining the seemingly inexhaustible lode of talent in New Orleans. Possibly his most lasting contribution was introducing Earl Palmer, the man who invented rock and roll drumming, as I'll try to prove on a later show. But in 1963, the face of New Orleans was changing, and Lou Chudd sold Imperial, which was having better luck with Ricky Nelson anyway. Dave Bartholomew was just a name on a bunch of old Fats Domino records until the mid-80s, when some French and German fans reissued the best of his work on three very hard-to-find albums. These days, he's still active, leading Fats Domino's band and playing a few jobs himself, one of the few rock and rollers out there deserving of the title a living legend.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Dave Bartholomew and his band will hit the road again early next year.
Well, I'm going to a party across the track. It's a hole in the wall, people call a crack. Do you want to jump, children? 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 Boy, you better stop flirting with married girls before you end up in another world. Do you want to jump, children? Do you want to jump, children?
This is Fresh Air. A few months ago on Fresh Air, journalist James Adams warned us that although the arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was winding down, there was another arms buildup threatening world peace. Dictators in developing countries were building their arsenals, including chemical and biological weapons. Today, Adams joins us from London to discuss Iraq's arsenal. Adams is defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London, and the author of the book Engines of War, Merchants of Death, and the New Arms Race. I asked him how Iraq developed their chemical weapons.
With a great deal of help from a number of Western countries, West Germany, for example, Austria, for example, France, for example, they've managed to piece together, using an overt and underground network of buying, to purchase the wherewithal both to manufacture and to build the capability for chemical and biological weapons, bearing in mind that these many chemical weapons have a base of agricultural and fertilizer type products, which with some variation you can turn into very deadly weapons. But the companies and the countries that supplied the equipment knew, I think, perfectly well what they were doing, but as so often happens in the arms business, it was a chance to make a buck or two, and no one looked at the consequences down the road, which, of course, the U.S. forces are now facing.
You've made the point in the past that chemical weapons are the equivalent of nuclear weapons for third world dictators. Do you think that the situation now illustrates your point?
Absolutely, because chemical weapons are very deadly. They are non-persistent in the sense that you can throw a chemical weapon into an area, kill the people who it affects, and if you have a non-persistent chemical, one that doesn't last very long, your own forces can go into the same territory minutes, hours, days later, depending on what the type you use. So as a war weapon, it is much more effective, and in terms of kills or bangs for your buck, or however one wants to phrase the awfulness of a particular type of weapon, chemicals are terrible, and their effect is not much different, in fact very similar to a tactical nuclear weapon.
What do you think the lesson is in Iraq about what our arms policy should be?
I think the key lessons that we have learned, which to some extent we already knew, but it's brought it more harder to home, is in the chemical and nuclear area, because one of the things that is driving everyone forward in this crisis is the capability that Iraq has to use both chemical weapons now and nuclear weapons at a time in the not too distant future. Now that's arisen because nations have been feeble in prosecuting embargoes on nuclear and chemical capability. Governments have turned a blind eye to the export of material that allows nations to develop that kind of capability. And the clear lesson from that is that we must be more stringent about this whole business in the future. Because if, after all, if you take away chemical and nuclear capability, what do you have left in Saddam Hussein except a rather low-level dictator with a lot of conventional military force that could be dealt with really without too much trouble with a fairly long-term campaign? But you can't allow a dictator like that, with the clear territorial ambitions he has, to remain in power if he is at the one time going to have a nuclear capability. You simply can't allow it. And there are plenty of other nations lining up to get this kind of capability as well. So it is a clear and harsh lesson to us all.
I wonder if you think it's almost too late in a way to stop the development of arsenals in third world dictatorships. So many dictators have huge arsenals now, in part because the superpowers helped arm them. If the superpowers stop arming them now, they still got lots of weapons.
I think that's absolutely right. And the worrying thing about the development in third world nations of this kind of capability is that, unlike among the superpowers, either in West or East, there is a clear willingness to use the weapons that they have. They're not frightened of upsetting another country or destabilizing the world. They're quite prepared to use what they have. So part of the strategic equation, if you like, of what's going on in the Gulf is to say to these other countries, okay, you may have this capability, but you want to use this, you watch out, because you know if you do so, there will be retribution, and that retribution will probably mean your own demise. So it is an important signal that is being sent through what is going on out in the Middle East to countries all over the world. Maybe that's the right way of doing it. It's a bit late in the day, but it is a way of dissuading countries that might otherwise use their weapons from doing so.
Well, the Soviet Union is sure in an unusual position now. It still has a little less than 200 military advisors in Iraq, and yet it's an ally with the United States and England in opposing Iraq's invasion of Kuwait.
Yes, but I think one needs to be slightly more sophisticated than simply looking at that headline, in that the Soviets have been extremely helpful to the United States in supplying accurate and timely intelligence on Iraq's military capability and on the current deployments. Now, one assumes, one doesn't know, but one assumes that some of those military advisors are of being of some assistance in this current crisis, although nobody clearly talks about that because the Soviets don't want them to be held hostage along with everybody else. So I think the Soviets have been much more helpful than simply having a number of advisors still in Iraq.
Alliances are changing in the Middle East, and Secretary of State James Baker is in Damascus. Syria has been on the United States blacklist of states sponsoring terrorism. Now it looks like Syria is becoming an ally in the Middle East. Do you think that this means that America and possibly England will in the future be supplying Syria with weapons?
Well, Syria is a very interesting state of affairs. If you go back 3 or 4 years, you could substitute Iraq for Syria. Iraq at war with Iran and a bigger enemy of the United States than Iraq had once been. Iraq, a sponsor of terrorism, but through political convenience, people decided that Iraq was actually an okay place and US could have diplomatic relations and help them with intelligence against the Iranians and so on. Now here we are, the Syrians, having played rather a skillful game, committed troops to Saudi Arabia to fight against the horrible Saddam Hussein. So there goes James Baker off to Damascus, and no doubt the Brits will do the same thing. But it would be useful to remember the lesson of Iraq. Now, President Assad has always been a devious, ruthless, extremely brutal dictator who is only after the interests of himself and his country, which should not necessarily coincide with the interests of the United States. The fact that it does now is one thing. Whether we should actually get into bed with him and forget all past wrongdoing, I think would be, if history is anything to go by, a very, very rash mistake.
You wrote a book called Secret Armies about covert forces being trained. And I wonder if you think there are covert forces that Americans don't know about that are being deployed now in the Middle East.
Well, I'm never quite sure what people know about, but the current deployment of special forces, covert forces, if you like, to the Middle East is the biggest deployment, I think, seen certainly since Vietnam, and indeed special forces in the US are probably more effective now than they were in Vietnam. So you've got around 500 sea air land team folk from the Navy whose job it is to clear the way for invasion force by sea and to do reconnaissance. You've got members of the intelligence support activity, which is a unit designed to operate behind enemy lines or behind potential enemy lines, some of whom have infiltrated into Kuwait and are passing back fairly useful intelligence about where landings could or could not take place, the disposition of Iraqi forces and that kind of thing. So there is a great deal of activity, and when the shooting starts there will be far more activity, which perhaps might not be helpful to go into, as I'm sure the Iraqis will be listening to this program when it goes out.
You say when the shooting starts, you sound pretty sure that there's going to be shooting?
I find it very difficult to conceive of a situation where Saddam Hussein is going to withdraw from Kuwait and give up his chemical and nuclear capabilities. And I don't believe that sanctions will force him to do anything. And indeed, sanctions in the end, when children start to starve, or even if they don't starve, I'm sure that Saddam Hussein will bring them out on television and say they're starving, then the Allied will to proceed will start to fall away. So I think that for every reason, military, political, tactical, strategic, I think war is inevitable. And I think we should resign ourselves to the consequences of that.
When you say war is inevitable, what kind of war are you envisioning?
Well, war, of course, in any form is terrible, but in the way that this one could be fought, the casualties might be relatively low. The Americans might lose under 5,000, might lose well under 5,000. The Iraqis might lose 20,000 to 30,000. You would fight, if they fight according to the way they would want to fight, the Americans would, or the Allied forces, would attack the air power of the Iraqis plus their chemical and nuclear capability, degrade their radar and radio communications, invade and take Kuwait City, establish a bridgehead to block and cut off the supply lines south for the Iraqi forces, and then use the air power, which is enormous, to destroy, comprehensively destroy, the Iraqi forces at the front, so that the Iraqis could not move forward. U.S. ground forces would not have to be engaged apart from in mopping up operations. It would be a devastating but short war.
James Adams, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Adams is the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and author of Engines of War, Merchants of Death, and the New Arms Race. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what do you have on the Souter confirmation hearings?
Well, Judge Souter is on deck, Terry, and he is defending his positions on civil rights, individual rights, and civil liberties, which are the areas where he's going to run into trouble, if in fact he does run into any trouble. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Colin Powell, is in Saudi Arabia. We have a reporter traveling with him, and we'll have a report. We're going to look at the institutions where juveniles are incarcerated. We've always separated youthful offenders from adult criminals, but those two institutions have changed over the years. And we're going to talk to a man who's about to become king.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mother-daughter relationships are volatile enough, but set a mother-daughter story in Hollywood and you've got theatrics. Postcards from the Edge is a new movie about a mother and daughter who are both in the biz. Actress Carrie Fisher, who's the daughter of Debbie Reynolds, wrote the screenplay based on Fisher's novel of the same name. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Something happens to Meryl Streep when she plays comedy. She changes. When you watch her suffering in exotic accents in movies like Sophie's Choice and Out of Africa, she seems oddly distant, as though instead of really suffering, she were doing an uncanny imitation of a suffering person. But when she plays comedy, and she hasn't done it very often, that lofty remove disappears. Suddenly she's warm, intimate, vulnerable, almost cuddly. She's flesh and blood without losing the actorish skills that give her every line a funny spin. If Postcards from the Edge were a better movie, you'd have more to think about while watching it than how terrific Streep is, but you don't. Carrie Fisher's screenplay is about being an almost successful young actress who has a super successful mom and a drug problem to prove it. But the movie is all flimsy postcard, no edge, And for a while, that's refreshing. Instead of the expected dark moonscape of addiction and withdrawal, Postcards from the Edge gives us bathtubs full of frothy banter. Much of it takes place on movie sets, and the behind-the-scenes material is hilarious. But after about 45 minutes, you can feel the movie look at itself in the mirror and say, "Okay, pal, time to get serious." That's when the fun stops, and the film gingerly begins to dig toward the roots of our heroine's drug problem. And that's when we start to get screechy, preachy scenes, like this one between Streep as Suzanne and her mother Doris, played by Shirley MacLaine.
"Will you please tell me what is this awful thing I did to you when you were a child?
You want to know?
I want to know. Tell me.
Okay, fine. From the time I was 9 years old, you gave me sleeping pills.
That was over-the-counter medication, and
no,
I gave it to you because you couldn't sleep.
You don't give children sleeping pills.
They were not sleeping pills. It was store-bought, and it was perfectly safe. Now, don't blame me for your drug taking. I do not blame my mother for my misfortunes or for my drinking."
"Well, you don't even acknowledge that you drink. How could you possibly blame your mother for something you don't even do? Remember my 17th birthday party when you lifted your skirt up in front of all those
people, including my skirt, Michael. It twirled up!"
MacLaine has lately become Hollywood's favorite Gorgon. She's one of the few star actresses of her age brave enough to look ghastly and behave grotesquely on the screen. And you have to admire her for that. But even though her performance as Streep's Mommy Dearest is accomplished, it's never quite convincing. You can see MacLaine condescending to her character. You can see that she thinks Doris is a monster, too. The movie is unusually starry. Dennis Quaid is on hand, looking not very comfortable as Streep's duplicitous lover. And there are cameos from people like Gene Hackman, Richard Dreyfuss, and Rob Reiner. There are even some songs. One over-the-top showstopper from MacLaine, and two from Streep, who really can sing. But it all seems like so much fluff. Ornaments piled high to distract you from the fact that the Christmas tree isn't there. And from one other thing. Streep, who's 41, is playing someone whose career and attitudes and problems all typify a person of 20-something. And you never get over the feeling that the whole movie is trying to get away with a little white lie. Still, when a performance radiates the way Streep's does, you find you can't see the lies for the glow.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
John Densmore was the drummer for The Doors. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us how he reacted to Jim Morrison's self-destruction. Also, Richard Werman on how to cope with information anxiety. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.